White Rocket Entertainment. White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 239. Welcome to the White Rocket Formula One Show. This is the second and final installment of the show for this year as we look back at the 2016 season. If you've been listening to our two regular shows on this network, either the AU Wishbone or the White Rocket podcast, neither of them is what this is, but it's going to be on their channel feed for the next couple of weeks. So everybody that wants to hear it can get a chance to hear it. Then we'll go back to the regular programming in the next few days. I am joined tonight for this episode. John is not with us this week. We have Alan Porter. Welcome aboard the show, Alan.
Thank you, Van. It's great to be with you. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, Alan is a writer of high adventure fiction, pop culture reference books, and comics. Sounds kind of familiar. He does a lot of the same sort of fields and things that I do, and so I've known him for 2 or 3 years now through that circuit. And I'm delighted to have him on to talk about another subject, which is Formula One racing. So first out, you got to let the folks know what your background is in terms of Formula One. Have you been a fan forever or just for a few years? What, you know, and what got you into it and all that?
Well, like most Brits, you just grow up with Formula One. It's part of the culture. You know, a bit like NASCAR is over here in the States. In the UK, Formula One is just one of the major sports. You're always aware of it. But I became a real fan. I'm really going to give my age away here. Early 70s, and I've been following it pretty avidly since the early to mid 70s. Really got into motorsport in the early 70s when the company my father worked for sponsored a local racer and took me to the local racetrack, and I was hooked. And I've been following every form of motorsport pretty much since then, but Formula One has always been close to being the number one sport that I follow.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. For those that didn't hear the previous and the first episode, just real quick, I was always a fan of IndyCar racing, and which is about as close in the United States as you really get to Formula One in terms of the shape of the cars and the open wheels and the different shapes of track and everything, though it is a bit different in several key ways that we talked about at length last time. But over the years, I had sort of stuck my nose in Formula One for a minute and kind of gone, okay, and then I'd kind of lose interest again. But at the beginning of this season, I watched very excitedly I was preparing to watch the Indy 500 this year for the first time in several years, because I always would miss it. I'd always think it was on Memorial Day, and it's on the Sunday before Memorial Day. So every Memorial Day I would turn the TV on, it's like it was yesterday. So this year I made a point to watch it. And while I was thinking about Indy, I said, well, you know what? If I'm going to start watching IndyCar for the first time in years, let's check out that other one, that Formula One thing, and see what that's all about. And I just happened to be coming in like in early March, right before this season started. And so I kind of got to get in from the very beginning this year. And, you know, people that listen to the White Rocket podcast know that when I get interested in something, I just turn into a sponge and I just soak up every freaking detail I can find about it as quickly as I can. That's just one of the things I love to do. And so I've just been soaking up. There's nothing in life I love more, Alan, than finding a new subject that's interesting to me, and I can just dive into the very bottom of it and just wallow in it for a few months. And so this has been really fun to me to find something I knew almost nothing about and just try to soak up as much as I possibly could. So you heard the previous episode. How have I done in terms of just like one season now?
You're doing really good. It's actually, I think I said this to you on Twitter, I'm actually loving reading your stuff and listening to your stuff of somebody who is actually new to the sport. Like I say, I've been watching it for, you know, 40 plus years now. And it's great to actually hear somebody who's coming out with fresh eyes, particularly from an American perspective as well. I tend to find that most people here in the States, we've lived in the States for 20 years. So most of the people I meet who love Formula One in the States have actually already pretty much been acclimatized to it and have watched it for many years. It's not many people I meet who are actually completely brand new to the sport. So it's actually been really fun to actually hear the enthusiasm that you've embraced it and the way that you've sort of gone deep into finding out about it. And like all writers, I'm the same. If I find a new subject or something, I disappear down the research rabbit hole for months on end too. So I'm completely with you on that one.
I'm glad it's not just me. Well, that's great. I tell you what, when I first got into, this is ties into it, when I first got into English soccer, as opposed to the international, you know, I've always watched the World Cup, international soccer, but I decided in 2006, I think it was, after the World Cup, to really start watching Premiership soccer. And there's a long process. I've got to do a soccer show sometime to explain how I became a Chelsea fan, but I ended up choosing Chelsea for a bunch of reasons that are just not germane to this. But in any case, as soon as I started watching them, they fired Jose Mourinho. And I'm like, oh man, just did I get into it, this really interesting character kind of leaves, you know, the team. Well, same thing here. I picked a driver at the beginning of the year. I did my research and I said, you know, I really like this Nico Rosberg guy. And he's retired.
Yeah. So who are you going to pick next year? Have we got a short list of people who are going to retire at the end of the year?
Yeah,
Kimi Raikkonen, he's probably going to be the oldest, most experienced one in the grid next year, so he's probably next one for retirement. So.
I was going to ask you, is it him or the Spanish driver, Alonso? It seems like he's been around a long time, hasn't he?
Yeah, but he's younger, so, and Kimi's retired once and come back, so, and I think he's only got one more year on his contract, so.
I call him the grouchy old dude.
Yeah, yeah.
He's hilarious, though. I love his radio messages and his when you can understand them and everything. I did actually a survey on Twitter to see what a bunch of my Twitter followers thought I should do. And the vote, I divided up into four categories because that's as many as you can do on Twitter. And I said, vote for who I should be a fan of next season since my driver, Nico Rosberg, won the world championship and then promptly retired, which we're going to talk about here in just a minute. My categories were Ricardo, Verstappen, the two Red Bull guys. Whoever gets Nico's Mercedes seat, and one of the never seems to win guys, and which would be like, you know, getting interested in English soccer and choosing Fulham as your team. Okay, so that's out because I'm an Auburn fan, and Auburn doesn't win things enough that if I'm going to get my choice rather than growing up, I'm going to pick one that has a chance to win. I suffer enough with Auburn to not need, you know, to choose somebody that wins once every 25 to 50 years, okay? So the vote came in about, if you added the two Red Bulls together, about 55% for them. And so what I think I'm going to do next year is start out just rooting for the Red Bull team, and then I'll see if I'm more interested in Ricardo or Verstappen as the year goes by. Certainly Verstappen is interesting, and we're going to talk about, let's go ahead and get into things. What do you think about Verstappen since I mentioned him now? He seems to be like the real drawing attention to the sport character maybe in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think this year was definitely the breakout year for him. What he did in Brazil was amazing. I think those last, 15 laps or 40?
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
I mean, he certainly seems to have phenomenal car control. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that spin in Brazil that he caught like 1 inch from the guardrail. And his only comment was, my heartbeat went up a bit. I mean, my heartbeat went up a bit. And I, watching the replay, I already knew he saved it. He seems to have that natural ability to find grip where other people can't find it, and to be able to read the racetrack and to understand that the race, his racecraft is brilliant for a 19-year-old. Yeah. Absolutely staggering. I think he's, you know, well, God willing, I think he's going to be, you know, one of the next real high flyers. I mean, if you go back sort of before him, Sebastian Vettel was the young phenomenon when he first arrived as a teenager, you know, and became the youngest person to win a race. And then before him, it was Alonso when he was the youngest person to win a race. But in terms of natural talent, you know, I like a lot of people, I don't think I've seen anybody like him since Ayrton Senna came on the scene in the 80s. He just seems to have that race maturity well beyond his actual years and just outright speed. I mean, races in the rain always throw up the, you know, who's going to be brilliant. I mean, Senna was brilliant in the rain. Michael Schumacher was brilliant in the rain. Natural talent comes to the fore in the wet. But even in Abu Dhabi, just, you know, the last race, watching him there, you know, on a perfectly controlled dry track and stuff, he was still on older tires and that he was still catching people that he shouldn't be doing and overtaking people, you know, that he's better than elders. I don't know. He just seems to be the real deal. And, you know, his dad was a pretty good Grand Prix driver. He wasn't a race winner and he wasn't a champion by any means, but he was a good, solid driver. And I guess growing up in and around that and karting from a young age, he's come in with, if you like, that background, that environment, where I don't think being in Formula One is phasing him like it would a lot of other kids his age, who come in, burn bright, you know, shine brightly and burn out very quickly and under the pressure of F1. I think he's got the inbuilt experience to actually handle that and not be fazed by any of the big names around him. So yeah, I think he's the real deal and somebody to really watch. And if I say my guy retired this year too, because I was a big Jenson Button fan. So I think I'm going to be cheering for Max Verstappen for next year as well.
Yeah, the guys on another podcast last week made a really good point, I thought. They said that when there was that early incident that put Verstappen back to the very back of the pack at the beginning of the race, they were very excited because he's much more fun to watch coming from the back than he is being at the front, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, you're talking about the last race at Abu Dhabi. I was the same, you know, when he got spun around, I was like, oh, no. And then it was like, oh, actually, this could be good.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, if he starts at the back of the grid every race, that'd be awesome. But
They should make him. They should make him start last and then just see how far he can get. Because, yeah, I mean, somebody was telling me the other day, they said, oh, I don't like Formula One because it's just a parade. They never pass each other. I said, well, you need to watch Max Verstappen. He passed, like, the entire field in 12 laps.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Actually, I mean, this season has been a lot of on-track passing, so it'll be interesting to see what happens next year with the new car designs. But
yeah, we're going to get into that too. So, so the way things started out when last we John and I spoke about this on the previous version of this show, we were wondering if it was going to be Lewis Hamilton or Nico Rosberg, and of course, the way it played out was that Lewis Hamilton won like the last four races. But Rosberg's lead was such that if he just finished second or third most of the way, he still was ahead by a few points, and that's what he did. I think Hamilton finished first in every race, and Rosberg finished second in every race, and so they were able to just kind of go steadily along, and Rosberg won. So first, I want you to tell us, you know, what you thought about how things played out there in the last, you know, four races in terms of Rosberg kind of not, he didn't go out to win the races so much, but he did what he had to do behind Lewis Hamilton. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about Rosberg and his retirement, but what did you make of how the season played out and how do you evaluate that?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest. I'm a big Lewis Hamilton fan. I've been watching Lewis since he was in some of the lower formula, always an amazing driver to watch. So I obviously got to support the home team as well, support the British drivers. But I think that, I don't know, I had a feeling from early on in this season that this was Nico's one chance to win a world championship. I always thought that if he did win one, he'd only ever win one title. And it turns out that was right, but not for the reasons I thought of. Cause I don't think he's ruthless enough to be a multi-champion like Hamilton. But yeah, I mean, Lewis is fast, but he doesn't have the luck and you have to make your own luck. I think he's fast, you know, and he pushes things and he pushes the car, and sometimes pushes the track limits, pushes the engine, pushes relationships. As we saw at Abu Dhabi, that doesn't always help. I mean, you know, at the end of the season, Lewis won 10 to Rosberg's 9. Lewis got more poles. He got more fastest laps. But Nico scored more points. There was only one race where Nico didn't score points, and that was Spain, where they took each other off. So, you know.
That's still hilarious to me. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that really made a big difference, didn't it? If it had been Rosberg crashing and Lewis had kept going, Lewis would have won the championship.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, if Lewis's engine hadn't gone in Malaysia, or right. if Lewis hadn't had that, you know, there was that period where for 3 or 4 races, Lewis just couldn't get off the grid and ended up, you know, 8th, 6th, and 8th and whatever it was at the end of the first lap. So, you know, he's always been a bit of a mercurial character. And I think, you know, Nico said after Austin last year, when I think their relationship hit the lowest, he was like, if you read the interviews, he's like, that's the point I knew I had to change my game to beat Lewis. And he went into 2016 with a different attitude. And I think I read that he said basically by Japan, he knew that all he had to do was bring it home second and follow Lewis. And that's what he did. And, you know, he did what he needed to. I mean, you know, his dad won his championship and only won one race that year. So yeah, his dad won the championship. So,
wow.
You know,
wow.
I guess it's a family trait, you know.
oh, wow.
So, yeah, I think it was a good season. It was interesting to see the dynamic between the two of them. There was some great racing. And I love the fact that the Mercedes team let them race. I know it caused, you know, some bodywork damage and some lost points. But I think it added to – it made what could have been a really boring season into a really good season by letting the two of them race, because those cars were so far ahead of anybody else. I mean, you could see that again in the last race when Lewis was deliberately going slow. But people still couldn't catch the two Mercedes, even when they're, you know, not – they're going – Lewis 9 seconds a lap slower than his qualifying speed by the end of the race at Abu Dhabi. But the Red Bulls and the Ferrari still couldn't get to them. So, you know, that car was so dominant that letting the two drivers race each other was a real benefit for the sport as a whole in the season, I think.
Lewis, this is Patty. This is an instruction. We need you to turn a 4-5 or whatever. I'm winning the race. Everything's fine.
Yeah, that's almost as good as Kimi Raikkonen's one from a few years ago of "Leave me alone, I know what I'm doing."
Yeah, you expect a comma, you blank there.
Yeah,
but that's what Sebastian Vettel was doing. Vettel was cracking me up in the second half of the season by just insulting everybody, just screaming about everybody, crying about everybody. It was just so funny. He's like the head of the not the guy that owns it, but one of the, you know, guys that runs Formula One. He's like, blank him. I don't care. I'm like, oh my gosh, you really don't want to be doing that, do you? I mean,
yeah. I mean, he's gone from being the hot young Turk to being the grumpy old uncle, I think. Especially when ignoring the blue flags and not letting him past and stuff. You know, get that Max Verstappen kid out of the way. He keeps passing me.
I do love when the Northern Europeans start screaming about something, because they get so high pitched and shrill. It's hilarious. Like, the Swedes are notorious. Like in tennis, when a Swedish tennis player starts screaming, it's always funny because it sounds like the Swedish chef on the Muppets. But I love when the Germans get, what is he doing? He ran into me. It's just cracking me up. So that's a lot of fun stuff that's going on this season. You mentioned Hamilton's tactics, and I want to get your view on that, because I thought it was interesting. I mean, I was of two minds about it. On the one hand, you can't blame him. And for those that don't know, I mean, what was happening was Lewis Hamilton in the last, what, 4 races or so, was just easily taking off from the pole position and until the very last race, really not even looking back, you know. And so Rosberg's job was to stay. If you couldn't pass him, and you don't want to do anything dangerous to try to pass him, because you don't need to, because he was going to win the world championship being in second every race, which is what ended up happening. But he didn't want to do anything dangerous to go after Hamilton. But on the other hand, he doesn't want to drift so far back that he starts running into the traffic coming up behind him, because, you know, the Red Bulls and the Ferraris are not at the level of the Mercedes cars. But honestly, those Red Bulls, and especially with those two drivers, which we're going to talk about in a minute, they're not that bad, and they could be real challenges next year. Again, we'll talk about that too. So Rosberg's trying to slot himself into kind of a safe space in between Hamilton in front of him and the Red Bulls, usually, and the Ferraris right behind him. And so what Hamilton does in that last race is he needs Rosberg to finish lower than third in order for Hamilton to win the world championship. So Hamilton just starts on the areas where Rosberg could have passed him, he speeds up. And on the areas where you can't really pass, he would slow down so much that he was pushing Rosberg back at the field in the hopes of getting him tangled up in there so that Hamilton could win the championship. So, assuming I have described it adequately there, what did you make of that? Because I'm of kind of two minds about it, but I want to know what you, who know much better than me, what do you make of that tactic and how it played out?
I would have been surprised if he hadn't done it. Okay. As you said, going into that race, the only thing he could do was win it and hope that Rosberg would finish below fourth or worse, wasn't it? Yeah. He wasn't on the podium. So he only had one card to play, which was get out front, slow the race down, and hope you can get two cars between him and Rosberg. So the only card he had to play was to back Rosberg up into the traffic if Rosberg was sitting second. And that's why Lewis is a third three-time world champion, and I'm sure he's probably going to win another couple more titles. I mean, mm-hmm. I think he said he wants to stay in F1 for another 10 years, so maybe he's got another three in him. Maybe he's even going to go after Schumacher's seven titles. I don't know. But, he's got that ruthless streak. All the multi-champions do, and that's what makes them multi-time champions. And, that was the only thing he could do was that one tactic. I'm surprised. I wasn't surprised he did it. I expected him to do it. I think earlier in the weekend, Christian Horner, the Red Bull boss, said in an interview that's what he expected Hamilton to do, and that Red Bull should make a go and try and capitalize on the fact that he would slow the field down, which is why they did their peculiar qualifying thing on trying to get on a different tire than everybody else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was what I expected. Didn't quite expect him to be quite so blatant about it, but he's not the only one who's done it. It's been done in the past, and at least he didn't deliberately crash his rival off the track to win the championship, which has been done several times in the past.
Wow.
Most famously at Suzuka back, and I think it was, I can't remember which year, but Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost when they were teammates. Basically, as long as Prost didn't finish, Senna won the championship, so he took him off at the first corner.
It's probably a good thing for the sport that Spain happened that early.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if it had happened later, people would have thought it was on purpose, deliberate.
Yeah. Like I said, I think it was the one card he had to play, and he played it. And that's why he's a three times world champion, and I'm sure he'll win a few more.
Right. Well, now the other element to it now that I want to talk about real quick, and this is something just popped up on the front page on Google on news here. The other element to it, though, is that Mercedes, who's the team that owns and runs both of their cars, okay, again, I'm trying to make sure everybody that's listening kind of understands what we're talking about, because we could drill down so far that we lose our audience that's just learning. But the Mercedes owns both their cars, Hamilton and Rosberg, and Mercedes was actually the guys that run it were actually coming on the radio over the helmet of Hamilton, and they seemed to be wanting him to go normal speed rather than slow down. And so the big controversy, I guess, has been that on the one hand, shouldn't Mercedes be okay with Hamilton trying whatever he has to try to win the championship versus them seeming to almost favor Nico Rosberg and discouraging Hamilton? And that's kind of the way Hamilton seemed to be taking it, is that they were taking sides. So how do you see that? I mean, who's right and who's wrong there, and what should Mercedes have been doing?
I didn't understand the Mercedes radio calls. I mean, they've always said they were going to let the two of them race. So I think they should have let them race. Some of it started when the others started getting too close, and they ran the numbers, and they're like, okay, Vettel's coming quicker on newer tires, and we've only got X number of laps left. If you don't speed up, there's a chance he could catch you. I think it started like that, and it sort of just seemed to escalate and it did start to seem like they were favoring Rosberg over Hamilton, just from the bits of the radio that we were picking up. Of course, the thing is that we only hear little snippets of the radio traffic that the broadcasters, the FIA, the people who run the sport, you know, deem that the broadcasters can use. So we don't get to hear everything. So we only hear the choice bits. But yeah, it did seem strange to me. I personally would have thought they should have just let them race and run their own races. So I'm not quite sure why it got to the point where the Mercedes technical director Paddy Lowe was on doing that. You know, this is the big boss, you need to speed up message, which seems strange. And now, if you, I think I saw something from a tweet from Paddy Lowe yesterday, and it was like, oh, everything's fine, we're good, we're all sorted. So I guess they talked about it afterwards and have figured out their new dynamic. And obviously, I think next year, and this is probably touching on the other subject, is the dynamic's going to be different, because I think they're going to have a clear number one and a clear number two in the team, or because I don't think they're going to get another top flight driver in that seat.
Yeah, we're getting to that in just a minute. That's a good point. Okay, well, one of here's the headlines, the three headlines that come up across my Google Formula One news thing, which I think are interesting. Let me just throw them out to you real quick, talking about that very thing. The first one is Niki Lauda. Now, those that listened to the last episode, I talked about that movie Rush, and Niki Lauda is the main character in it. He's the Austrian driver that was burned, and now he's one of the top executives with the Mercedes team, kind of one of the bosses. So Niki Lauda upset that Nico Rosberg is breaking Mercedes' F1 contract. In other words, he is upset that Nico is retiring. Okay. The second headline is Mercedes now, quote unquote, fine with Hamilton's Abu Dhabi tactics. So Mercedes now, like you just said, doesn't seem to be having an issue with him backing Rosberg into the field. And then third, and I love this headline, Formula One won't miss Rosberg and he won't miss it. So, what do you make of those headlines? Any particular order or any one of them that you want to comment on?
Okay, I'll go in reverse order. I don't think Nico Rosberg will miss Formula One. He's a very wealthy young man with a nice boat and a house in Monaco and, you know, nice family. And I think he's going to, you know, enjoy his retirement and, you know, settle into family life for a few years. Actually, my daughter and I were talking about that this evening and over dinner, and I reckon a couple of years, I wouldn't be surprised if he pops up driving a Le Mans sports car or going into the German Touring Car Championship, which is something his father did after he retired. That's quite a common thing for ex-F1 drivers to end up in the DTM series, the German Touring Car series. So I wouldn't be surprised if he spends a few years at home relaxing and then gets back in. I don't think he'll miss Formula One at all.
I'm sorry. Our audio has a little lag. It's kind of messed up, but I'm sorry. I wanted to ask you something about what you just said there before we move on. Somebody made the good point. I think it was one of the commentators said that, it was Bernie Eccleston, the guy that owns Formula One or is the main guy. He said Nico has he needs more time to spend his money.
Yeah,
I thought that was interesting. But I was just going to say, Alan, wouldn't it be nice if all of us could retire in our 30s to our house in Monaco and our yacht, you know?
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it?
That would be nice. All right, number two. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Will F1 miss Nico? No, I don't think so. F1's a cruel sport. You've got to be really special to be missed in F1, and I don't think Nico is special. I think he was good. And this year was his year. He was a deserving world champion. But I don't think, with all due respect, I don't think he's one of the greats. I don't think he'll be missed. Mm-hmm. The people who tend to be missed tend to be the ones whose potential was never fully realized. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, luckily, we're not in that period anymore where people got killed on a regular basis. But people like Francois Chevert in the 70s or Gilles Villeneuve in the 80s, who died really early before they fulfilled the potential. Mm-hmm. Or somebody who is, you know, very special, like Michael Schumacher or Ayrton Senna. Those are the people who tend to get missed. Mm-hmm. It's been a lot of one-time world champion drivers who, you know, are in the record books but not necessarily missed or looked on with, you know, as a legend or that. So, yeah, I don't think Nico will miss F1. I don't think F1 will miss Nico. I think that's fair enough, to be honest. Okay, what was the, then there was the...
Well, the other two were just talking about Mercedes is now fine. You sort of addressed that already, though, that they kind of got together and decided, apparently talked it out, so...
Yeah. Niki Lauda, Niki's always been a BS merchant, even from his early days as a driver. He knows how to generate good headlines. He knows how to get attention. I don't think he's upset with Nico breaking the contract, other than the fact it means more work for them because they've got to go out and find another driver. I don't know if you've seen the list of names for the seat, but everybody who's still walking is pretty much being talked about, including Niki Lauda. put Niki Lauda back in the seat. Let's put Nigel Mansell in the seat. And a few people are like, I wish Jenson Button's regretting that he's taking his sabbatical now, and you know he could get step into that car. I think every TV commentator who ever sat in a race car is. People have been tweeting photographs of themselves stood next to the empty Mercedes. It's been quite funny watching a lot of the older drivers saying, my number, just give me a call. So.
It really is. It's like the 85 Bears are halfway through the 85 season, and suddenly they need a quarterback to replace Jim McMahon. And I mean, you know, Jim McMahon's quarterbacking was never anything that really drove the Chicago Bears of 85, but they still were amazing. And so it's like every quarterback in the NFL and every retired quarterback is like, I could do half a season with the 85 Bears, no problem, you know. So it's interesting to see all these because, you know, somebody points out on the one hand, you know, it's kind of late in the day to be looking for a driver. All the deals have kind of been done. But on the other hand, it's that car.
Yeah. You know? Which is, I mean, you mentioned Rush earlier. If you watched that movie, the famous story is, you know, James Hunt, who's the other protagonist in that movie, basically his team folded at the end of the season and he was without a drive. And the only seat that he could get was that McLaren, which was the top seat because their driver had suddenly quit to go off and race for his brother. So there was an empty seat in the top team, and then there was a driver suddenly without a seat, and he drops in it and he wins the world championship. it's interesting to we're in a bit of a replay of that 76-77 close season thing where, you know, there's an empty seat in the top car on the grid and everybody's eyeing it up, you know, who's. Because everybody thought the musical chairs had been pretty much sorted out for 2017, and all of a sudden it's blown the whole market open. So, I think Vettel's going to stay at Ferrari. I think Ricciardo and Verstappen are going to stay at Red Bull. Alonso, I'm not sure. I think he's only got 1 year left on his McLaren contract, and then he talked about doing Le Mans with Porsche in 2018 or 2019. So. Whether he would make that jump, it's interesting. There's been a lot of memes of him and his famous deck chair photograph sitting outside the Mercedes headquarters.
Yeah, there's a meme going around of him like sunning himself, and they keep sticking him next to other things, I think is what you're talking about. Well, see, here's the thing. You understand from my perspective, as I watch all this, everything pretty much that I know about the sport, I've seen this year. Right. So when you talk about Fernando Alonso, to me, he's the Jacksonville Jaguars. He's he's Charlton. I mean, I haven't seen him do anything, and I've seen him in a lesser team getting 9th, 10th, 11th place every week, and so. Tell what is it about him that we should know that would make that I should get excited about him being in that other car and why he would deserve it?
I would say that Alonso, in terms of pure skill, until Max Verstappen arrived, was probably the only one who was on a par with Hamilton. He's already two times world champion. When he came in, he blitzed the sport. He was the youngest Grand Prix winner. When he arrived, Renault, he won multiple championships, multiple races. He did spend some time with McLaren for a year, then went to Ferrari, really helped Ferrari get back on their feet after Michael Schumacher, the seven-time world champion left. Alonso really built Ferrari around himself, and then moved back to McLaren to help them sort of rebuild with the Honda engine on a, you know, 4-year program, of which they're halfway through. You know, you've got to look at that team. They may have been running sort of 9th, 10th with Alonso and Button, 15th or 16th. But, you know, those guys have got 3 world championships between them. They're not slouches. They're fast drivers. So you've really got to look at, you know, what he does with a car that he pushes the car beyond what it's really designed to do or where it should naturally be running. Alonso is always several places ahead of where you think that car should be. And as when we were lucky enough to be at the race in Austin, well, you know, Lewis won the race, Hamilton won the race quite clearly. I'll tell you, the last probably 20 laps, the guy to watch on track was Alonso. He was doing things with that McLaren that nobody should have been doing with that McLaren. We were down at the hairpin, and I'll tell you, he was braking visibly later than anybody else and turning in harder and rotating that car around the front wheels like nobody else was doing with their cars. He was amazing to watch. So, yeah, I think he – a lot of people believe, and I would do it, he is one of the 3 top drivers on the circuit and has been for many years. He just needs to be put back in a car that would approve that, and I think the Mercedes – the logical choice is to put him back in the Mercedes, but I don't know what his McLaren contract or more to the point, probably his Honda contract is and how that would affect whatever future plans he's got. Because he's already, as I said he's going to go with Porsche in sports car racing. So we will see, but I'd love to see him back in a competitive car.
You know, I think that it, if I finally ever get to go to a race, it would presumably be in Texas. I'm gonna have to go with you because I need you to sit next to me and just tell me what I should be paying attention to, because I'm not sure I would get as much out of it without, you know, really knowing what should I be watching here.
It is interesting because I've been lucky enough to see Formula One at Austin, several races at Austin. When the Grand Prix was at Indy, we went to a few of those. And before we moved to the States, I got to see Silverstone, Brands Hatch, the British Grand Prix. A couple of Belgian Grand Prix at Spa as well. So, but it is interesting. It is actually harder to watch live now than it used to be. Cars are quicker, but actually the drivers are now so well protected. It's very difficult to actually spot which driver is which live because they come past at such a speed. And the numbers on the cars are so small. It was interesting. You mentioned the Indy 500. We were at the running of the Indy 500 this year, and it's actually easier to spot which driver is which in an Indy car coming by you at 200 miles an hour because they got big numbers on them and they got a digital readout on the side of the slide pod that airbox that tells you what position they are in the race.
Yeah.
I wish Formula One would do that because, I tell you, watching it from trackside, unless you really know the cars and the individual drivers, it's pretty difficult to track who's who.
Yeah, I have the thing I figured out is the only difference really besides the numbers, and in some cases their logos and their numbers look so much alike. I'm looking at the logo trying to figure out if it's a number, but the only way you can tell them apart is that apparently the senior driver has a black camera thing over their head, and the junior driver has a tennis ball colored thing over their head, like a camera thing. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. The onboard camera bar above the airbox, yeah, is a different color. And I'll tell you, with Hamilton and Rosberg, the way I did it when we were watching it, because they both were wearing black and white helmets, which didn't help, is that they have different colored gloves. And, you know, I think Hamilton's were white and Rosberg's were lime green, or the other way around. I can't remember which way around it was. But it picked up pretty quickly that you could actually tell them from the driver's gloves as they were, you know, negotiating the hairpin as to which was which. But some of them you can pick out really, really quickly, but so yeah, some of the others you sort of had to really look. Another reason that I sat by the hairpin because it's actually the slowest part of the circuit, and they've all got to slow down, and it makes it easier to recognize them. So
yeah, well, yeah. Now another thing though is that in IndyCar, every car is different, and in Formula One, you have pairs that are virtually identical. I wish they could just like do them negatives, like if Hamilton is silver with teal trim, then have Rosberg or whoever be teal with silver trim. I mean, at least that way you'd have some difference.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be before sponsorship, they were all national colors. You know, the American cars were blue, the British cars were green, Italian cars were red. But they all used to have the name big, you know, about the size of the corporate sponsor logo now. That used to be the driver's name on the side of the car. and with a big ass number on it too, so it made it a lot easier. But unfortunately, you know, that's real estate you can sell for sponsors. Therefore, the sponsor names got bigger, and the car ID stuff got smaller. So
Hey,
I do like the team stuff. Having been to several NASCAR races, it's difficult to know. Like Richard Childress Racing has got four cars. It's like, hang on, is that a teammate or not? I don't know, because they're all completely different color schemes. So
Yeah, IndyCar, I mean, you got like, you can't miss the Target car, or Ryan Hunter Ray's DHL car is bright yellow and red. I mean,
right.
It is a little easier. Yeah, it's funny. IndyCar is kind of like halfway between Formula One and NASCAR in that way. In a way, they kind of look like Formula One, but another way, they're kind of dressed up like NASCAR. It's funny how they're.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Let me ask you one other technical question about the cars while we're talking about the cars. How do they go an entire race without putting any gas in?
Because they're hybrids. that's part of the formula. Is that you have a certain amount of fuel. Well, actually, it's a sort of like a fuel usage limit that they're only allowed to pump a certain liters of fuel per minute to run them over a maximum of two hours on track.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's up to you to design an engine and hybrid unit that can do that. It used to be they used to have refueling, and refueling was great. It was really exciting. And occasionally a pit would go up in flames. Luckily, nobody ever got too badly injured. They used to have pretty much like the IndyCars and NASCAR, not quite like NASCAR, but they used to have big pressurized refueling rigs, and they used to come in and as well as change four tires, they used to refuel the cars as well. That was interesting. I always liked the refueling side of it. It was interesting to watch. And they were all mandated rigs. So every rig was set up by the FIA. So they all pumped the gas at the same rate and stuff like that.
Mm.
But after a couple of pit fires, it was deemed too dangerous. Mm. To keep in line with where, automotive engineering is going, it was like, let's move them to a hybrids. And that's what a lot of people don't realize about Formula One cars, is they are actually hybrid cars. A lot of folks here in Austin who are not particularly keen on the fact we have a Formula One track outside make remarks about them being gas guzzlers and the amount of fuel they're wasting. And I'm like, you do actually realize they're actually produce more power per liter than a Toyota Prius does, and they are hybrids. hybrid Formula One is a hybrid formula. Le Mans has been won by hybrid cars for the last several years. So most people don't realize that these are technically green cars, and they do an amazing amount of mileage on a very small amount of fuel now.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, well, I was always just wondering about that. That's interesting because the Indy cars for sure they still fuel up every stop, and so the pit stops take like 15, 20 seconds or whatever, which is insane. But the Formula One pit stop takes like 4 seconds.
Mm. Well, even what's the world record now? Just under 2 seconds.
Golly!
For the Formula One pit stop. It's insane. Sometimes you blink and it's like, did they actually stop?
It's amazing. Okay, last few things here on, and then anything you want to throw in that I've missed. We've talked a good bit about you. I mean, I was going to ask you, the question was floating out there, is Nico Rosberg a deserving world champion? I don't like that question. I find it kind of insulting, but it's being asked a lot, particularly in the British media. And I guess that's because it was, Hamilton that he beat, and it's Germany and all that kind of stuff. I get that. It's kind of a rivalry thing. I understand that. I would ask, is Alabama really a deserving champion? Oh, yeah, they are. Is it that he's just more of a technical driver? I mean, the way you've kind of been describing him, just the way it's coming across to me is like Hamilton is ruthless in a good way, whereas Nico was more of a technical driver, and he was able to kind of technical his way to one world championship. But, that's not going to happen every year, or maybe any other year, and he might not have ever won another one if he'd stayed in 10 more years. So, I mean, how do you evaluate that in terms of what does that even mean? Is he a deserving champion?
I have no idea what that means. I think anybody that comes out on top of the points and gets the championship is a deserving champion. I don't think there's been anybody who doesn't deserve the title. You could have said that about going back to, 82 when his father won, and he only won one race that year, but he still scored more points than anybody else. So that makes him a deserving champion. That's the game. That's how you play it. I think it's a stupid question. I think anybody that wins the championship, unless they do it by cheating, which nobody has that I know of, is a deserving champion. I think you're right. He was probably more of a, for want of a better phrase, a more technical driver in, particularly this year. I think what he did this year was he put a game plan together of what he needed with his own mindset. Hamilton is notorious for playing mind games. He does all sorts of stupid stuff. I don't know if you read that thing about Abu Dhabi, but he basically when he got to the track, he parked his rental car so close to Nico Rosberg's that Nico Rosberg couldn't get back in his car. He does stupid things about, making remarks about how many times I've won as against the fact that you've only won it once. And he's always been, that's part of the game. The multi-time champions do a lot of that sort of stuff of the mind games. And that's what Hamilton plays. And I think this year Rosberg was like, okay, I've got to get myself to the point where that's not going to annoy me anymore. I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to focus on it. And, all year he was doing that. I'm just focusing on this race. And that was like, it became his mantra. And that got him to the end. And he didn't have the ups and downs that Hamilton does. So one of the reasons I like Hamilton is that, other than the fact he is, incredibly fast, and has car control, and like Verstappen will make passing moves on places that you don't think there's a room. He tends to have up and down. He'll win three or four races and then something will happen, or he'll go off the boil a bit and then he'll come back strong. That makes him interesting to watch. I guess it's the turtle and the hare thing. Rosberg was slow and steady. Well, not slow. He was steady throughout the season and kept pulling in the points. So, of course he's a deserving champion. He won the championship. What else is there to say?
I seem to kind of agree. And I was glad that I was surprised when he retired, but it made sense for him. Like you said, you wouldn't have ever dreamed Lewis Hamilton would do that. But when Rosberg retired, I was like, surprise. Yeah, I can kind of see that,
Yeah, I mean, I think he's only the third driver who's actually done that in the history of the sport, won the world championship and said, okay, that's it, I'm done. The last one was Alain Prost, I think, and then he came back to win another world championship. So, I must admit, like everybody else, I was pretty stunned when I saw the news. But the more, once you read his statement, it's like, yeah, okay, that fits with his character, and I can see why he's doing it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You get the sense that rather than somebody that wanted to dominate the sport, he just wanted to win that world championship one time, and he would be fulfilled by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what he said. He said, it's been my personal mountain for 25 years, and I've climbed that mountain. Now I'm good. So
good, yeah. Good to go, right. Yeah, I think after the kick six in 2013, Auburn should have just dropped football. We could just walked away. We did the greatest thing in the history of the sport, and we can just now walk away. Let's talk about the other teams real quick. The Red Bulls and the Ferrari guys. All season I was saying, what's wrong with Ferrari? I was coming into this sport thinking they were going to be awesome, and they were kind of the third in qualifying every time, and they were third in finishing among those three big teams. And then and the Red Bulls, who I guess apparently were dominating a couple of years ago, were kind of the second team all year, just a step behind Mercedes. Of course, in the last race, it was Vettel, I guess because of the tire strategy and stuff. It was Vettel with Ferrari that came charging up rather than Verstappen. Oh, I'm sorry. That reminded me of the one other thing I want to say about Rosberg, and I'm done with him, and that is the one thing he did, because I was like, if he just cruises along in second place week after week after week after week, I'll be happy that he won because he was kind of my guy this year, but it's kind of boring. And the one thing he had to do that made me feel like, okay, he kind of earned it, was he passed Verstappen. They told him, you need to get around Verstappen. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's going to try to get around Verstappen. They're going to crash and he's going to lose the world championship. And danged if he didn't do it. And I said, okay, if you pass Max Verstappen and don't crash and get around him and hold it, you deserve to win.
And it was an aggressive move, too. It wasn't necessarily the best place on the track to bat.
Right.
I mean, when he went for the move, you're like sort of half watching it with one eye shut, waiting for the crash. So, I agree with you. That was a championship-worthy move just there, right at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. So what about the Red Bulls and the Ferrari guys? I mean, they've been dominant in other years, right? And Mercedes just hit on some engine formula the last couple of years that's made them so good right now. And can we expect the other guys to come back now?
Yeah, I mean, it goes in cycles. There's always been periods, you know, in the history of the sport, be it Ferrari, have had their periods of dominance, Red Bull, Renault have had their appearances of dominance. Williams was the team at a time. McLaren were the team for many, many years. Pretty much as you go down the grid until you get, you know, the top half of the grid anyway, pretty much every one of those teams has had a turn at the top being the dominant team. So it will cycle around. It may be when Mercedes decide to pull out, whenever that may be, and you know, that team moves on to be somebody else. Because that team used to be the Honda team at one point. Mm. So, you know, those people in that factory have actually been through several ownerships and several labels. It's interesting as you track these teams back through their history as to which teams evolved into what other teams. I think Mercedes have been dominant, been dominant in this last three or four years. As we mentioned, sort of alluded to earlier, that the formula is about to change. The car designs are going to change in 2017. So pretty much everybody's back on a blank slate. It'd be interesting to see if some of the others backed off developing the 2016 car to put resources into developing the 2017 car. Well, Mercedes, because they were up front, had to keep focusing on the 2016 car. So, you know, whether they're going to catch them up, everybody seems to be looking to Red Bull probably to lead the charge next year because they've got the best designer in F1 in Adrian Newey. And they've got two really good drivers in Ricciardo and Verstappen. I've heard a few things where, you know, is it going to be those two vying for a championship next year? And Ferrari, I think Ferrari are just going through too many internal battles and political problems at the moment. Whenever Ferrari's parent company of the day get involved in running the Formula One team, their results always take a hit. The years that they're left alone to just be Scuderia Ferrari and race Formula One, they do better when they're stable for a few years. And Ferrari also just lost their very talented technical director, James Allison, who's retired back to the UK. So I don't know. I think they may – I wouldn't expect much from them from next year, to be honest. I mean, the ones that have really surprised me this year have been Haas, the new American Formula One team.
Yeah.
They came out sixth place in their first race, ended up eighth in the championship, which is the highest a new entrant has done in like over 10 years, which is really cool. They don't have sponsors driving them. Gene Haas's business is big enough that he's basically funding it himself. And I think he said he's going to fund it for like 4 or 5 years before he went looking for sponsorship. So, it'd be interesting to see where that goes. And they've got a slightly different driver lineup next year. They started strong and then faded. They had some design problems around the brakes in the second half of the season. So I hope they get that fixed because that's pretty important.
yeah, I guess so.
But yeah, they were good.
Force India looked like they were having a really good. I don't know much about them at all. I just knew that they were right in there in the mix.
I mean, Force India, fourth, that's the highest they've ever finished. They're another team that's been through numerous identities over the years. I think this, under one of their previous identities, they ended up third in the championship 1 year. To get back up. But compared to the other teams around them, their budget is minuscule compared to Ferraris or Red Bulls or even Williams. So, I think they've done a great job. Williams were a little disappointing. I thought they might do better with two really good drivers, but we'll see what happens. Sponsorship from Martini, so they had a good budget, but they didn't seem to quite hit it. Like I said, McLaren are on a rebuilding with having lost their relationship with Mercedes and switched back to Honda engines. They're on a sort of rebuilding program, so I think they're broke back halfway through that rebuilding program. But again, they've just had a big change at the top of that team with the longtime 30-year-old boss getting ousted in a boardroom coup. So they've now got a new American boss. Then the new head of the team is an American guy, Zach Brown. So we'll see how that goes. And actually, Renault were quite surprising. They took over what used to be the branded Lotus team that had basically been wound down to almost nothing, and they bought the assets and are rebuilding. And to me, one of my other standout drivers of the year was actually Julian Palmer, the other British driver, who I, you know, was a little slow to start at the beginning of the year, but the second half of the year came on strong and really outperformed his teammate Kevin Magnussen, who is an ex-McLaren driver. So, you know, Kevin Magnussen's been around for a while. So I think Julian Palmer's done a really good job at Renault, and interested to see how he goes on next year with a new teammate. So, and I think Renault will probably pull back. Well, we're going down the list. I guess that's the only other ones left. Sauber, who I think they just, Peter Sauber, who founded the team, it was bought out this year, so they kept the name, but it's completely new ownership, and they've been struggling for money. So I'll be interested to see if the new ownership manages to generate any significant sponsorship. But so they've been a bit disappointing. Toro Rosso, the Red Bull Junior team, doing what they always do, you know, finding talent, promoting talent. Carlos Sainz Jr. is fairly interesting. When he was actually looking in his mirrors, a lot of the time he didn't look in his mirrors. It's a bit of a roadblock. And we got the right at the back, the Manor team, who again have gone through numerous changes. That was actually Richard Branson's Virgin team, I think, originally, and then has been through numerous ownerships. They're off the pace, but I think they're like 5 seconds off the pace this year. No, 3 seconds off the pace this year. But last year they were 5 seconds off the pace. So, you know, they're making progress. And they scored a point, and if they can stop the two drivers running into each other like they did at the last race, they'll do pretty well, I think. I think they'll always be a back-end team, but it'll be interesting to see where they go in the next couple of years. And they have a Mercedes engine, so, you know, as long as they keep running Mercedes engines, I think they'll do okay.
They're the Detroit Lions of Formula One.
Yeah.
Well, we actually have a couple of questions from listeners that have come in today, and the first one is the one I've been wanting to ask you, because I think this is the big question I'm wondering about right now. We haven't really addressed it very intently yet, so let's address it now. Steven Schuster, a loyal listener of my various shows and a follower on Twitter, says, do you think Mercedes will try to steal away an experienced driver from another team to maintain dominance, or will they roll the dice with a rookie?
Like I said earlier, I think the only top driver who's in with a shot is Alonso, but I don't know what his contract situation is. I don't think Mercedes will buy anybody out of a contract, a top driver out. They've said they don't want to mess with the leading teams, but it's Formula One. You know, what they say one day could be completely different the following day. I said to you on Twitter, I thought it might go to Valtteri Bottas, who drives with Williams, mainly because he's managed by Toto Wolff, who was the manager of the Mercedes team. There's no such thing as conflict of interest in Formula One, by the way. You may have started noticing this, that team owners can also be managers of drivers in other teams and managers of drivers in their own teams. And yeah.
I was kind of absorbing that.
Yeah. So I, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if Toto Wolff managed to get Valtteri Bottas to be a number two to Hamilton. There is actually also Pascal Wehrlein is another German who is a Mercedes junior driver who drives for Manor, who has been basically tweeting all week, I'm not going to push it and I'm not going to ask, but I'm ready if they ask me. So he's sort of been doing this quiet, not so subtle quiet campaign on social media. Of, you know, raising his hand and saying, hey, I'm a Mercedes contracted driver and I'm down at the back of the grid. Give me a chance. So, you know, he might end up in the slot. So for me, I'd put my money on either Bottas or Wehrlein ending up in that seat and an outside shot at Alonso. And I'd, like I said, I'd love to see Alonso in a front-running car again. I think that would be awesome, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, the one that I think would be absolutely riveting to see would be, and I know it's not going to happen at all, would be if Max Verstappen was up there with Hamilton in the two Mercedes. That would make the very pedestrian driving Rosberg in a way just look like, I mean, it would be unbelievable, but obviously it's not going to happen. But tell me this, I mean, Bottas, I don't really even barely remember them calling his name. I remember Wöhrlein mentioned several times, but was Bottas in one of the white cars, the Brazilian driver that retired? I mean, I just don't remember him doing much.
Yeah, he was in one of the white Williams cars along with Felipe Massa.
Yeah, Massa.
Again, when he pretty fast driver when he first came in. I don't think the car he's driving really suits his style particularly. Mm. There have been a couple of other Finnish drivers who've come in pretty fast and faded pretty fast too. So I don't know, he may be like that. Wöhrlein may be the better bet. The point of Verstappen in the Mercedes. I don't want to see Max Verstappen in a front-running car because I want him to be in cars where he has to push them to get them to the front, because that's where that's where the drama will come. It's him actually pushing a car past its limits, I think, would be great. I think something like Mercedes would be, in inverted commas, too easy for him. I think he would just run away. I mean, him and Hamilton in same equipment would, I think, be interesting. Yeah. But I'd much rather see him fighting his way through the grid and entertaining us all in a car that normally runs third or fourth. So.
Yeah, you know, I was going to mention this earlier, and I forgot to mention it, that when you're talking about how he brakes so late and how he controls the car, I don't think I ever fully appreciated that until Brazil, where it was pouring down rain most of the race. Because there was one moment where even with my totally untrained, inexperienced eye, I could see it blatantly. There was this one moment where another car was on the inside, on the left, to turn left, and Verstappen was coming up from way behind him on the right, on the outside. And the car that was turning left on the inside starts slowing down to take the turn. And in the rain, okay, because you have to be careful, you're going to slide right off the track. I don't know that Verstappen touched the brakes until he was already past the guy that was turning on the inside. He went past him without even slowing down and then hangs that corner like on two wheels or something and goes by him like he's sitting still. And I'm watching that going, he has no fear that he's going to wind up in the grandstand, you know? I mean, he just blew by him in the rain on a turn.
Yeah, I mean, him and Hamilton, sometimes, you know, watch some of Hamilton's onboard of his pole laps, like at Abu Dhabi, where the long back straight and he's going down it, and you're thinking, he's got to hit the brakes, he's got to hit the brakes, and he doesn't. And it's like, what the hell? You know, then he just seems to dab the brakes and turn it, and the car goes around the corner, and it's like, how the hell? And, you know, You watch those G monitors and they're pulling like 5G when they hit those brakes. And it's like, how the hell do they do that lap after lap after lap? Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. Our other question, because one of them we already have addressed. Joe D asks, if I want to learn more about the sport, what would be a good book or video to start with? That's an interesting question. What do you know that the rest of us don't know that you could kind of point us to? It'd be an interesting thing to read or to watch. Besides, Rush, I think, is really good. But besides that.
Yeah, Rush is a good good movie and tells fairly fictionalized, but it's a good summary of the sport in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Senna, if you've not seen it, the documentary by Ayrton Senna, probably the greatest driver of the modern era, is also an exceptional movie. Ooh. Very moving. But actually, will sort of it's aimed at the general public, so it does a good job of explaining the sport as well, and some all the background machinations and stuff that go on. Gives you a really good feel for the history of the sport. That's a good one. In terms of reading, wow. I actually just read a really good book called Racing Driver. I'm going to have to very quickly look at who wrote it, because that's terrible. I've forgotten who wrote it. But it's by the journalist who runs the Red Bull newspaper that circulates around the paddock, who was at one point McLaren's PR officer.
I heard about that. I heard that they do their own little newspaper that they give out.
Yeah,
it's so funny.
They do. It's a really good one. It's a little dated because it was obviously written around 2006, so it stops just as the 2007 season about to start, so it's 10 years out of date. Mm. But it gives you a good background on the drivers, the cars, what a driver needs to be. It's all around about how, you know, what do you need to be a Formula One driver in terms of mental preparation, physical preparation, and, you know, the stresses and strains that the sport actually puts on people. And it's a really good book, and I'm struggling here to find the author. Give me a second.
Yeah, we have just one more little segment to go.
A guy called Norman Howell.
Norman Howell.
Racing driver. F1 through the driver's eyes, heart, and soul.
Okay.
And if you want another one about the past, there's one called The Piranha Club, which is about the Formula One team owners.
I like that.
Which is also very good. And again, going back past, one of my favorite driver biographies is Jackie Stewart, 3-time world champion from the 70s, who became the advocate for driver safety and then ended and ran his own Formula One team, Stewart Racing, which was the genesis of what Red Bull. He's now Red Bull. His autobiography, I think it's called Winning Ways, is also, but Jackie Stewart, that's an excellent racing biography as well.
Oh, I grew up seeing him on television at the Indy 500 every year. Jim McKay.
Yeah, did a lot of commentary work too.
Yeah, he was always so fun because Jim McKay was like the steady main commentator, and then Jackie'd give all the kind of color commentary on the side, you know, and with his accent and everything. It was always fun when I was a little kid to hear and see Jackie Stewart. He was great. I saw him interviewed in the paddock area by the NBC Sports Channel guy a few weeks ago, and that was neat because I was like, I didn't even know if he was still alive. Wow. And they were talking to him, and that was just really cool to see him again for the first time I'd seen him in probably 25 years. So,
just one thing on that.
Yeah.
The best publication to learn about and keep up with Formula One is a magazine called Motorsport. It's been around since the 1920s. It's covered the sport since the 1920s. It's still going around strong. It's a monthly. You can get it in Barnes & Noble. But they actually have an excellent website, motorsport.com. They put most of their articles actually on motorsport.com. And they also tweet, and they actually do a regular monthly podcast, which is also very good, with interviews with various people from various forms of motorsport, but has a strong Formula One focus. Motorsport magazine, just Google it. It's a great resource.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate that. That's awesome. All right. Last thing we'll wrap up is expectations and predictions for next year. Now, you mentioned that they're changing the cars a good bit. We'll have a new driver in one of the best cars. There's going to be quite a bit of shakeup in Jenson Button's retiring, and probably. And Felipe Massa is retiring. So it's going to be a different season next year in a lot of ways than it was this year. What do you expect and what do you predict is going to happen?
Cool. The cars are going to be different. They're going to look a bit more old-fashioned, if you like. They're going back to wider tires and bigger wings, which should give them a little more aero grip. They're talking about the cars being 3 to 5 seconds a lap faster. Mm. Now, I don't know if that's really going to change the spectacle much on TV, but the braking distances are probably going to get even shorter, which is going to be interesting. That's going to be something to watch for. In terms of the team, like I said, I think hopefully, you know, every time you get a new formula, you tend to get a bit more parity between the teams, unless somebody figures out some real tweak in the regulations that nobody else has spotted, which is what happened in 2009. So I think you're going to get more parity. I don't think Mercedes is going to be quite as far out front. We're all going to be watching the early testing with interest as the new cars roll out. I think Red Bull are going to be more up front. I don't think Ferrari are going to do much. The big question mark is that Mercedes second seat, because, you know, what happens there is going to really affect the rest of the grid. There's a new, you know, the new guy coming in at McLaren, Stoppel, can't remember his last name.
Van Doorn.
Stoppel Van Doorn, thank you.
What a great name. I can't forget that name. I can't remember anybody else's name, but I can remember that.
Yeah. He's coming in with a great reputation. He's meant to be, you know, sort of not quite on a par with Max Verstappen, but he's meant to be that sort of, you know, young hot shot. And then there's another 18-year-old coming in at Williams. So the grid is definitely getting younger. So I think there'll be a few more young charges there getting in the people's way and maybe taking other people off. It's going to be interesting. I mean, it's going to be another long season. They're talking another 20 races, and didn't I see the French Grand Prix is back in as well. So another 20 or 21 race season. I mean, I don't know if you realize, but this is the longest season ever. Normally seasons were like 16 to 17 races. 21 is the longest F1 season in history in 2016. So
I was very happy about that. I got a race almost every 2 weeks or every week there from March all the way till November. That was fantastic.
Yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it too. But, it's a hell of a strain on the drivers and the teams, because it is truly a world championship. I mean, they do a hell of a lot of traveling. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Next season is really interesting because the next season is a big question mark. I mean, we've had 3-4 years of, you know, Mercedes dominance with that driver lineup. So it's going to be a whole new ball game, as they say. Starting next season. I think winter testing is going to be really interesting as to who shines, who's sandbagging, and who's found the killer. You know, the killer modification or the killer hole, the hole in the regulations that nobody else has spotted that lets them do something special with the car design. So I'm really looking forward to 2017. It could be fun.
Well, me too. I just got a Mercedes pullover, which now I'm going to have to throw in the closet and never wear again because I've got to go get me a Red Bull shirt. But I do see that Sky Sports. Do what?
I said it can hang next door to my Jenson Button baseball hat.
That's right. Oh, we don't tell Mira, but we did get her a Lewis Hamilton teal colored Mercedes baseball cap. She was really wanting one, and it's one of those got like his little signature stitched on the bill or whatever. So she's going to be very excited because some of you know, my daughter who is 8 is a huge Lewis Hamilton fan. So the day of the last race, she just went around all day growling at me all day because she doesn't like Rosberg at all. She's Lewis Hamilton. So. I see that Sky Sports has the odds up for next year already. I don't know if you've seen it. Number one is Lewis Hamilton, 6-5. Number two is Max Verstappen at 5-2. And number three is Daniel Ricciardo at 7-2. So it's Lewis Hamilton and the two Red Bulls. But you got to think that'll change depending on who ends up in that other Mercedes car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It'll be interesting. All right. Alan, why don't you tell the folks as we wrap up here what of yours you want to kind of let them know exists, what they can go check you out in, and what they might want to read or whatever that you have been involved in.
Wow. Okay. Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Alan J. Porter, where I tweet about pop culture stuff, my books, and a whole lot of stuff about motorsports, mainly Formula One, but other motorsports too. And you can follow me on Instagram at Alan J. Porter. And my website is wordpress.alanjporter.com. And you can find lists of the books I have on sale. So I've written stuff around I've written books about James Bond, Batman, Beatles, Star Trek. And I've written comics for Marvel. I wrote and Disney. I wrote the Cars comic book for a couple of years. So you can find the Cars trade paperbacks. And like Van, I do some pulp fiction, high adventure stuff. I've written some Sherlock Holmes stuff and Alan Quatermain and all good stuff like that. So you can find all that on my websites or, like you say, follow me on Twitter and I will pimp my books and talk about motorsports.
Absolutely. It's very good follow. All right. Well, Alan, I can't thank you enough for coming on tonight. John and I took the first episode to kind of like explore what little we knew. And I was very excited to get you on here tonight to kind of share your in-depth knowledge so that our show actually sounds somewhat credible. John and I, John and I call our Auburn football show Almost Credible Sports Discussion, so I think tonight we're a little more than almost credible.
I really enjoyed it, and if you want to do it again in 2017 at various points in the season, I'd be more than happy to do that.
You got it. If we can keep having people actually tune in and listen to our show, we will do that. Thank you so much, Alan. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian. It's been great.
All right.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.